Holmes Drake. Holmes, here is a madman coming along.
Where?
There, down in the street. It seems rather sad that his relative should allow him to come out alone.
It was a bright, crisp February morning, and the snow from the day before still lay deep upon the ground. Down the centre of Baker Street it had been ploughed into a brown, crumbly band by the traffic. But at either side, and on the edges of the footpaths, it still lay as white as when it had fallen. From the direction of the Metropolitan Station came a man of about 50, tall, portly and imposing. But his actions were in absurd contrast to the dignity of his dress and features, for he was running hard, and as he ran he jerked his hands up and down, waggled his head, and twisted his face into the most extraordinary contortions. Whatever can be the matter with him? He is looking up at the numbers of the houses.
I rather think he is coming here.
Here?
Yes, consult me. I recognize... Mrs. Hudson, please show our visitor in.
He entered our room, still puffing, still gesticulating, but with so fixed a look of grief and despair in his eyes that our smiles turned in an instant to horror and pity. For a while he just swayed and plucked at his hair, like one at the extreme limits of his reason. Then suddenly, springing to his feet, he beat his head against the wall, with such force that we both rushed upon him and tore him away to the centre of the room.
Be easy, sir.
You have come to tell me your story, I think. I shall be most happy to look into any little problem which you have to offer.
Oh, no doubt you'll think I'm mad.
I think that you have had some great trouble.
God knows I have. Public disgrace I can bear, and every man must suffer private affliction, but both together have been so frightful a fall. It has shaken my very soul, but it is worse than that.
Worse?
I tell you, gentlemen, the very noblest of around may suffer if there some way can be found out of this horrible affair.
Gently, sir, gently. It's better. Now, tell me who you are and what has befallen.
I am Alexander Holder, senior partner of Holder and Stevenson of Threadneedle Street.
The largest private banking concern in the city.
The second largest. Pray continue, Mr. Holder.
At the bank yesterday morning, I received a visit from... Well, I shall say only that he is one of the highest, noblest, most exalted personages in England. I was overwhelmed by the honour and attempted to say so, but he plunged at once into business with the air of a man who wishes to hurry quickly through a disagreeable task.
Mr. Holder, I've been informed that you're in the habit of advancing money.
You found us, sir, when the security is weak.
It is essential that I should have £50,000 at once. I could, of course, borrow such an amount 10 times over from my friends, but I prefer to make it a matter of business. Until next Monday. I have a large amount due to me, and I shall then repay you with interest, but I must have the money at once.
In justice to my partner, I must insist that every businesslike precaution should be taken.
I should prefer to have it, sir. You have doubtless heard of the Beryl Coronet.
One of the most precious public possessions of the Empire.
Precisely. It contains 39 enormous barrels, and the price of gold chasing is incalculable. The lowest estimate would put the worth of the coronet at double the sum that I have asked. I am prepared to leave it with you as my security. You doubt its value?
No, not at all. I only doubt
the propriety of my leaving it. I should not dream of doing so were it not absolutely certain that I should be able in 4 days to reclaim it. It is a pure matter of form. Is the security sufficient? You understand, Mr. Holder, that I rely upon you not only to be discreet, but above all to preserve this coronet with every possible precaution. Because I need not say that a great public scandal would be caused if any harm were to befall it.
Sir, you must assure that the utmost care will be taken of it while it is in the possession of this bank. When evening came, I felt that it would be imprudent to leave such a precious thing in the office. I decided that for the next few days I would carry the case with me, so that it might never be out of my reach. I called a cab and drove out to my house in Streatham. I did not breathe freely until I had taken the coronet upstairs and locked it in the bureau of my dressing room.
Please describe your household.
My groom and my page sleep out of the house, though they may be set aside altogether. I have three maidservants who have been with me a number of years and who are quite above suspicion. Another, Lucy Carr, has only been in my service a few months. She is a very pretty girl, but has admirers who occasionally hang about the place. That is the only drawback that we have found to her. She came of an excellent character, and we believe her to be a thoroughly good girl.
And what of your family?
I am a widower, and have an only son, Arthur. He has been a grievous disappointment to me, Mr. Holmes. People tell me that I have spoiled him. Very likely I have. Perhaps it would have been better for both of us had I been sterner, but I meant it for the best. Some years ago, he became a member of an aristocratic club, where he learned to play heavily at cards and to squander money on the turf, until again and again he had to implore me to give him an advance upon his allowance, so that he could settle his debts of honour. He tried more than once to break away from the company that he was keeping, but each time the influence of his friend, Sir George Burnwell, was enough to draw him back again.
Burnwell? He has a reputation as a man of the world, I think.
He is a brilliant talker and very handsome. I could not wonder that he should gain an influence over my boy. Arthur has frequently brought him to my house, and his life could hardly resist the fascination of his manner. Yet, when I think of him in cold blood, away from the glamour of his presence, I am convinced that he is not a man to be trusted. So I think, and so too thinks my little Mary, who has a woman's quick insight into character.
Mary?
Or my niece. When my brother died 5 years ago, I adopted her, and have looked upon her ever since as my daughter. She is a sunbeam in my house. Sweet, loving, beautiful, a wonderful manager and housekeeper. I do not know what I would do without her.
True godsend.
In only one matter has she ever gone against my wishes. Twice my boy has asked her to marry him, but each time she has refused him. If anyone could have guided him into the right path, it would have been she. But now, alas, it is too late.
Pray continue, Mr. Holder.
After dinner last night, I told Arthur and Mary of my experience, though I suppressed the name of my client. Lucy, who had brought in the coffee, had left the room. I'm sure of that, but I cannot swear that the door was closed.
So, Father, where have you put it?
In my bureau.
Oh, but any old key will fit that bureau. When I was a youngster, I opened it myself, with a key to the boxroom cupboard.
Oh, Arthur, surely you didn't.
I did so, on at least three occasions.
Then I shall have to dispose of that key. Now I think I shall retire. Good night, my dear, and good night to you, Arthur.
Father, may I have a word, please, in private?
If you must. Come to my room in 15 minutes. Enter.
Father, can you let me have £200?
No, I cannot. I have been far too generous with you.
You've been very kind, but I must have the money, or I can never show my face inside the club again.
And a very good thing, too.
Oh, you would not have me leave it a dishonoured man. I couldn't bear the disgrace. I must raise the money. If you will not let me have it, then I must try other means.
Oh, you shall have not a farthing from me. Now go. When he was gone, I unlocked my bureau and made sure that my treasure was safe and locked it again. Then I started to go round the house to see that all was secure. As I came down the stairs, I saw Mary at the side window of the hall, which she closed and fastened as I approached.
Tell me, Uncle, did you give Lucy permission to go out tonight?
Certainly not.
She came in just now by the back door. I'm sure she has only been to the side gate to see someone, but really, it is hardly safe.
We shall speak to her in the morning. Now, are you sure that everything is fastened?
Quite sure, Uncle.
Good night, then.
Good night, Uncle.
At about 2 o'clock in the morning, I was awoken by some sound. There was a door to the window that had been closed somewhere in the house. It was not my wife, but I was close to the The gas was half up, and my son, in his shirt and trousers, stood beside the light with the coronet in his hands. He appeared to be wrenching it or bending it with all his strength. Arthur! You villain, you thief! How dare you touch that coronet?
Father!
You blackguard! You have destroyed it! You have dishonoured me forever! Where are the jewels you have stolen?
Stolen?
Yes, you thief!
There are none missing. There cannot be any missing.
There are three missing, look! And you know where they are. I saw you trying to tear off another piece.
You have called me names enough. I won't stand it any longer. Since you've chosen to insult me, I will leave your house in the morning.
You shall leave it in the hands of the police.
You'll learn nothing from me. If you choose to call the police, let them find what they can.
Uncle, whatever is happening?
Poor Mary had read the whole story at a glance. But by now, of course, the whole house was awake. I sent the housemaid for the police, and when they arrived, Arthur, who had stood silent and sullen, asked me if I intended to charge him with theft. I told him that it was no longer a private matter, since the ruined coronet was national property.
At least you will not have me arrested at once. It would be to your advantage if I might leave the house for 5 minutes.
So that you can get away, or perhaps conceal what you have stolen. For God's sake, Arthur. It's not only my honour that is at stake here. You have been caught in the act, and no confession could make your guilt worse. If you will only tell us where the barrels are, all shall be forgiven and forgotten.
Keep your forgiveness for those who ask for it.
He was taken into custody, and a search was made at once of his person, of his room, and of every part of the house where he might have hidden the gems. No trace of them could be found, nor would the wretched boy speak for all our persuasions and threats. This morning he was taken to a cell, and I have hurried round to you to beg for your help in unravelling the matter. Spare no expense. I have already offered a reward of £1,000. I have lost my honour, my gems, and my son in one night. Oh, God, Mr. Holmes, what shall I do?
Do you receive many visitors?
Only my partner and his family, and an occasional friend of Arthur's. Sir George Burnwell has been several times lately. No one else.
Then do you go out much in society?
Arthur does. Mary and I stay at home. We neither of us care for it.
That is unusual in a young girl.
She is of a quiet nature. Besides, she is not so very young. She is 24.
Evidently, she is very much affected by this
business. Oh, indeed she is. Even more so than I.
And you have no doubt as to your son's guilt?
How can we have? I saw him with a coronet in his hands.
That is hardly conclusive. Was the rest of the coronet damaged at all?
Yes, it was twisted.
Might he not have been trying to straighten it?
Oh, God bless you. You are doing what you can for him and for me, but if he is innocent, why did he not say so?
And if he is guilty, why did he not invent a lie? His silence appears to me to cut both ways. What did the police say about the noise that woke?
They thought it might have been caused by Arthur closing his bedroom door.
A likely story. As if a man bent on felony would slam his door and wake the household. And what do they think has become of the missing gems?
Well, they are still checking the floorboards and probing the furniture in the hope of finding them.
Have they looked outside the house?
Yes, the whole garden has already been examined.
This appears to you and the police to be a simple case. To me, it seems exceedingly complex. Do you suppose that your son came down from his room, went at great risk to your dressing room, opened your bureau, took out the coronet and broke off a small portion of it, went off to some other place, concealed 3 gems with such skill of nobody could find them, and then returned with the other 36, exposing himself to the greatest danger of being discovered? I ask you now, is such a thing to me?
But what other explanation is there?
It is our task to find out. Now, if you please, Mr. Holder, we will set off for Streatham and glance a little more closely into details.
A short railway journey and a shorter walk brought us to the modest residence of the great financier.
The lane on the left leads to the stables, and that is the tradesman's path on the right.
Leading to the kitchen door? I must examine the front of the house first, then I'll look at the path in the back and see what I can find there. The snow may be our friend, Mr. Holder.
Will he be long, do you think, Dr. Watson?
Probably.
Well, then let us go into the house and look for him there.
While we were sitting in uncomfortable silence in the dining room, the door opened and a young lady came in. She was rather above the middle height, slim, with dark hair and eyes which seemed the darker against the absolute pallor of her skin. Her eyes were flushed with crying. Disregarding my presence, she went straight to her uncle.
You have given orders that Arthur should be released, haven't you, Uncle?
No, my girl, the matter must be fully investigated.
But I'm sure that he is innocent.
Then why is he silent?
Oh, who knows? Perhaps he's angry that you should suspect him.
How could I help suspecting him when I actually saw him with the coronet in his hand?
But he had only picked it up to look at it. Oh, do let the matter drop.
I cannot let it drop until the gems are found. You are so fond of Arthur that you don't consider the awful consequences to me. I've brought a gentleman down from London to investigate the matter.
You, sir?
No, my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. He is looking for evidence outside the house. Ah, But here he comes now.
Sir, I trust that you will succeed in proving that my cousin is innocent of this crime.
So do I, Miss Holder. So do I. May I ask you a question or two?
Please do, if it may help to clear this horrible affair up.
You heard nothing yourself last night?
Nothing, until I was awoken by the loud voices from my uncle's room.
Did you fasten all the windows before retiring?
Yes.
Were they all still fastened this morning?
Yes.
One of your maids has a sweetheart. I think you told your uncle last night that she had been out to see him?
Yes, she was the girl who waited upon us after dinner. She may have heard my uncle's remarks about the coronet.
I see. You think she may have gone out to tell her sweetheart and that the two may have planned the robbery.
But what is the good of all these theories? I've told you that I saw Arthur with the coronet in his hand.
Patience, Mr. Holder. We must come back to that. About this girl, Lucy, you saw her return by the kitchen door?
Yes. When I went to see if the door was fastened, I met her slipping in. I saw the man, too, in the gloom.
You know him?
Oh, yes. He's the greengrocer who brings our vegetables.
He stood to the left of the door?
Yes, he did.
And he has a wooden leg?
You are like a magician. How do you know that?
I should like to go upstairs now. Pray, lead the way, Miss Holder. Which key was used to open this bureau?
The one my son mentioned, the key to the box room cupboard. It's here, on the dressing table.
A noiseless lock. No wonder it did not wake you. I presume the coroner...
Those stones are the finest I have ever seen.
Just so. Now, Mr. Holder, here is the corner corresponding to the one that has been so unfortunately lost. Might I ask you to break it off?
Oh, I should not dream of trying.
Then I will. I feel it give a little, but it would take me all my time to break it, and I am exceptionally strong in the fingers. An ordinary man could not do it. Now, what do you think would happen if I did break it, Mr. Holder? There would be a noise like a pistol shot. Do you tell me that all this happened within a few yards of your bed, and yet you heard nothing?
I do not know what to think. It is all dark to me.
Perhaps it may grow lighter as we go. Now, your son had no shoes or slippers on when you saw him.
He had nothing on but his trousers and shirt.
Thank you. Fortune has favoured us, Mr. Holder, and it will be entirely our own fault if we do not succeed in clearing the matter up. Now I shall continue my investigations outside.
For an hour or more he was at work, returning at last with his feet heavy with snow and his features as inscrutable as ever.
I think I have seen all that there is to see, Mr. Holder. I can serve you best by returning to London.
But the gems, Mr. Holmes, where are they?
I cannot tell.
And my son? Can you give me no hope?
He is innocent. I'm sure of it.
Then, for God's sake, what was this dark business that was acted in my house last night?
I think I shall be able to answer that question if you call on me at Baker Street tomorrow morning, between 9 and 10. Now, I understand that you give me carte blanche to act for you, provided only that I get back the gems, and that you place no limit on the sum I may draw.
I would give my fortune to have them back.
Oh, I don't think it will come to that. Goodbye, Mr. Holder.
We were in Baker Street again before 3. Holmes hurried to his room and returned within a few minutes dressed as a common loafer, with his collar turned up, his shiny, seedy coat, his red cravat and his worn boots. He was a perfect example of the class.
This should do. I may be on the trail in this matter, or I may be following a will-o'-the-wisp. You shall soon know which it is. I hope to be back in a few hours.
I had just finished my tea when he returned, evidently in excellent spirits, swinging an old elastic-sided boot in his hand. He chucked it down into a corner and helped himself to a cup of tea.
I only looked in on my way to Barton Square. Don't wait up here.
How are you getting on?
It is a sweet little problem, and I would not have missed it for the world. However, I must get these disreputable clothes off and return to my highly respected son.
When I came down to breakfast in the morning, there he was, with a cup of coffee in one hand and the paper in the other, as fresh and trim as possible.
You will excuse my beginning without you, Watson.
Ah, there is our client.
Only 2 days ago, I was a happy and prosperous man, without a care in the world. Now I am left to a lonely and dishonoured old age. My niece Mary has deserted me.
Deserted you?
Yes, her bed has not been slept in, her room is empty, and a note for me lay upon the hall table.
Watson?
Very well. My dearest uncle, I feel that I have brought trouble upon you, and that if I had acted differently, this terrible misfortune might never have occurred.
I had said to her last night, in sorrow and not in anger, that if she had married my boy, all might have been well with him.
I cannot with this thought in my mind, ever
again be happy under your roof. Do not worry about my future, for that is provided for. And above all, do not search for me, for it will be a fruitless labor and an ill service to me. In life or in death, I am ever your loving Mary.
What does she mean? Holmes? Not suicide, surely?
No, no, nothing of the kind. It is perhaps the best possible solution. I believe, Mr. Holder, that you are nearing the end of your troubles.
You have heard something, Mr. Holmes. You have learned something. Where are the gems?
You would not think £1,000 apiece too much to pay for them.
I would pay 10,000.
3,000. There is a little reward, I fancy. Have you your checkbook? Here is a pen. I'd better make it out for £4,000.
There you are, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you so much.
You have it! I am saved! I am saved!
There is one more thing to owe.
Name the sum, Mr. Holmes.
The debt is not to me. You owe a very humble apology to that noble lad, your son.
Then Arthur did not take the gems?
I told you yesterday, Mr. Holder, that he did not.
Then let us go at once and tell him that the truth is known.
He knows already. When I cleared it all up, I went to see him. Since he would not tell me the story, I told it to him, upon which he admitted that I was right.
Then for heaven's sake, tell me too.
I will do so, and I will show you the steps by which I discovered it. But I must tell you first that there has been an understanding between Sir George Burnwell and your niece, Mary. They have now fled together.
Mary? Impossible.
Unfortunately. Certain. Sir George is one of the most dangerous men in England. A ruined gambler, a desperate villain, a man without heart or conscience. Your niece knew nothing of such a man. When he breathed his vows as he had done to 100 before her, she flattered herself that she alone had touched his heart. The devil knows just what he said, but she became his tool and was in the habit of seeing him nearly every evening.
I cannot and will not believe it.
Last night, when she fortunately retired, Mary slipped down and talked to her lover through the window that opened onto the stable lane. The news of the coroner had aroused his lust for gold, and he bent her to his will. I have no doubt that she loved you, but there are women in whom the love of a lover extinguishes all other loves. Then, seeing you coming downstairs, she closed the window and told you about Lucy's escapade with her wooden-legged suitor.
Go on.
Arthur had gone to bed, and he slept badly. In the early hours, he heard a soft tread pass his door, so he rose and, looking out, was astonished to see his cousin walking stealthily along the passage until she disappeared into your dressing room. Presently, she emerged, and in the light of the passage lamp, he saw that she carried the precious coronet.
My Mary?
He passed down the stairs, and he followed cautiously to see what she might do in the hall beneath. Horrified, he saw her gently open the window, hand out the coronet to someone in the gloom, and then, closing it once more, hurried back to her own room.
I see. He loved her, and dared not take any action while she was present for fear of exposing her.
Precisely. But the instant she was gone, he rushed down, just as he was, his bare feet, opened the window, sprang out into the snow, and ran down the window, to see his dark face in the room. The door burned out of the in your room, he saw that the coronet had been twisted in the struggle and was attempting to straighten it when you appeared and confronted him.
Is it possible?
You roused his anger by calling him names at a moment when he felt that he deserved your warmest thanks. You cannot explain the true state of affairs without betraying his cousin.
That was why she shrieked and fainted when she saw the coronet. Oh my God, what a blind fool I've been.
And he's asking to be allowed to go out for 5 minutes. He wanted to see if the missing piece was at the scene of the struggle.
How cruelly I've misjudged him.
I searched carefully outside the house for any traces in the snow that might help me. Along the tradesman's path, just beyond the kitchen door, a woman had stood and talked with a man whose prints showed that he had a wooden leg. I could tell that they had been disturbed, for she had run back swiftly to the door, while he had waited a little before going away. In the garden, I saw only the random tracks of the police, but in the stable lane, found a long and complex story written in the snow. There were the tracks of a booted man and others belonging to a man with naked feet, plainly your son.
boots had walked both ways, but it was obvious that the other had run swiftly after him. At the hall window, boots had worn all the snow away while waiting. 100 yards down the lane, I saw where his pursuer had caught up with him, where they had struggled in the snow, and finally, where a few drops of blood had fallen. Boots had then run down the lane, and another little smudge of blood showed that it was he who had been hurt.
Mr. Holmes, I can hardly bear to think of the outcome had I left this matter in the hands of the police.
Inside the house, I saw that someone had climbed out through the hall window, and the outline of an instep showed where the wet foot had been placed when coming in. The events were becoming clear in my mind, but who was the booted man, and who had brought him to the corner? When you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. You did not bring him down, so there only remained your niece and your maids. Your son would not allow himself to be accused in place of one of the maids. But he loved his cousin, so there was an excellent reason why he should retain her secret. Remembering that you had seen her at that window and that she had fainted on seeing the coronet again, I felt sure that I was right.
But what led you to suspect Sir George?
Only a lover could outweigh the love and gratitude that your niece must feel towards you. I knew that your circle of friends was a very limited one, but among them was Sir George Burnwell, a man of evil reputation among women. It must have been he who wore those boots and retained the missing gems. He knew that Arthur had discovered him, but he also knew that the lad could not say a word without compromising his own family.
The devil.
I went in the shape of a loafer to Sir George's house, picked up an acquaintance with his valet, and learned that his master had cut his head the night before. At the expense of 6 shillings, I made sure by buying a pair of his cast-off shoes. With these, I returned to Streatham and saw that they fitted the tracks exactly.
Ah, I saw an ill-dressed vagabond in the lane yesterday evening.
I had my man. But I knew that a prosecution must cause a scandal, and so astute a villain would see that our hands were tied. I went and saw him. At first, of course, he denied everything, but when I gave him every particular that had occurred, he tried to bluster and took down a life preserver from the wall. I clapped a pistol to his head before he could strike. I told him that it would give him £1,000 apiece for the stones he held. That brought out the first signs of grief that he had shown. Why, dash it all, said he, I've let them guard 600 from the tree. I soon managed to get the address of the receiver who had been promising that there would be representation. After much haggling, I got our stones, £1,000. Then I looked in upon your son, told him all went well, and eventually got to my bed at about 2 o'clock. I thought I'd make a really hard day.
A day that has saved England from a great public scandal. Sir, I cannot find words to thank you, but you will not find me ungrateful for what you have done. Now I must fly to my dear boy and apologize to him for the wrong that I have done him. As to what you tell me of poor Mary, it goes to my very heart. Not even you can tell me where she is now.
I think we may safely say that she is my innocent daughter, and that whatever her sin may be, they will soon receive
for radio by Chris Drake. You heard Jim Crozier as Sherlock Holmes and Dave Hawkes as Dr. Watson, with Ivor Jevons as Alexander Holder, Sarah Bell as Mary Holder, and Mark Preston as Arthur Holder. The Noble Visitor was played by Brian Adrian, and the announcer was Angie Budd. The play was directed by Roger Johnston and produced by Dennis Ricard for Posse Clog Productions.